I'm 10 years old, and I've just been picked up by my mother after a Saturday morning drama class. I've climbed into the back seat of the car, filled with the contentment after a morning of creative play and eager to get home, comfortable in the rhythm of my day and life. Life is good. From the driver's seat, I hear my mother's voice break into my contented reverie. Deborah, go and help that blind person across the street. What? I sit up and I look through the front window. On the corner, across the street, is a figure with a white cane waiting. I freeze. I've never been asked to do anything like this before. And these are the days before we had those push buttons at the corners of streets that would make the lights change and make it safe for people with disabilities to get safely across the street. Even in those days, Broadway Street was a very busy four-lane highway almost. Go on, my mother repeated. Go on. Go and help that person across the street. I'd never done anything like this before. I'd never even been near a blind person. I didn't know what to do. So sensing my hesitation, frustrated, I think, she says, go and stand beside them, say you're there to help them walk across the street, they'll put their arm on yours, and then you'll just simply walk them across the street. Well, the instructions were reasonable, yet my fear continued to stop me from moving. The big, silent, invisible clocks ticked away, another lost opportunity. Finally, my mother herself got out of the car and helped the person cross the street. Man, was I ever ashamed of myself. But I've never forgotten that moment. The lesson my mother was trying to teach me was learnt, albeit in a less than positive way for my self-esteem at the moment. But getting past that, the lesson that we are responsible to others in helping others has always stayed with me. It was one of those small life-changing moments. It awoke in my 10-year-old self-awareness that there were strangers all around me to whom I could connect. People who I didn't know, who didn't know me, yet there was now this expectation that I would look for those who needed help. In fact, this idea grew into a moral understanding that to be part of our society, it was my duty, my moral duty, and my responsibility to help where it was needed, where I could see the need. Liberal religious theologian James Luther Adams is quoted as saying that religious liberalism affirms the obligation to direct one's effort toward the establishment of a just and loving community. To me, this means that to be a religious liberal, as we are here, is first of all to be truly connected and living in this world. As liberal religious people, we're not waiting for the next world. There may be a life after this. We just don't know for sure. But we do know that this world right now is worthy of our focus. This world between being born and dying, with all its beauty and all its pain, this is our world, our playground. It is a place to which we take our highest ideals, the ideals of justice and equality, the inherent dignity of every single human being, a respect for all life, and through our individual and collective actions, make these ideals real. As liberal religious people, without a creedal belief to tie us together, we look to our values and our principles as the foundation or guideposts that affirm the moral obligations to act. In our tradition, there are many Unitarians and Unitarian Universalists who have acted from a moral obligation. I can think of two women, one British and one American, who acted on their determination of moral right and wrong and changed the society that they lived in. Florence Nightingale in Britain and Dorothy Dix in the United States. Both at about the same time in history saw a moral wrong and addressed it with practical and political determined action. Florence Nightingale, you might have an image of, and you'd probably be wrong if you thought of her as this sort of fragile, demure savior of soldiers, the Lady of the Lamp, as she was known. Her father was a Unitarian, and I am so amazed that at a time when women were not expected to do more than marry and procreate, the women who had the opportunity to break out of this societal pattern managed to do so because their fathers, for the most part, made sure that they got an education. So it was with Florence. Her father, William Edward, made sure she was not only well-read, but that she knew how to think, which means that she could analyze a situation and problem-solve. This she did when she went to the Crimean War and discovered that there were more soldiers dying due to injury and the unsanitary conditions than there were dying on the battlefield. She wrote a paper on germs decades before it was commonly practiced or known. Florence was not only practical, but she also had instilled in her the Unitarian values of being in and of this world, and she affirmed the moral obligation to make this world a better place than what she found it. She had a spiritual awakening when she was 17 years old that ignited in her a desire to serve humanity and set the course for her life. So in just one example, because Florence did an awful lot of things, she organized the area for injured soldiers, introduced simple sanitation practices, and invited women to care for the injured. Women who wanted to participate but could not be soldiers. And thus beginning the profession of nursing in Europe. Dorothy Dix in the United States knew of Florence Nightingale, admired her, and emulated her. Dorothy later in life became an advocate for American nursing and a powerfully effective social reformer. Despite Dorothy's father being an alcoholic and a violent man, he did teach Dorothy the basic skills of reading and writing. Again, an unusual opportunity for a woman in the early 1800s. Home life for Dorothy was violent and neglectful, and so she ran away from home at the age of 12. She eventually made her way to Boston and surrounded herself with Unitarians, free thinkers who emphasized the goodness of God. Her father was a brimstone and hell savior kind of father. The free thinkers who emphasized the goodness of God, openness to new knowledge, and the moral obligation to contribute to the common good of society. In 1841, a friend of hers who was a ministerial student was frustrated in trying to teach a class on religion in the local women's jail, so he asked Dorothy for some help. Dorothy decided to teach the class herself, and it changed her life again. She was shocked that in the jails there was no heat, that hardened criminals, the mentally ill, and the developmentally challenged were all mixed together. So she embarked on a mission to reform the conditions for the mentally ill. Hers was one of the very first known social research projects for which she demanded to actually see and record the atrocious conditions that the mentally ill lived in the institutions. She went and forced her way in to many of these institutions because they did not want it known what was happening in them. She took her research, her firsthand research, to the politicians, and though they tried to deny it, her research finally convinced them for the need for change, and thus began an effective transformation of the American prison system and the separate establishment of institutions for the mentally ill. We are not a religious tradition with a creed, says James Luther Adams, a Unitarian theologian, but a religious movement that has always wedded social justice work to theology. These two women didn't let the deficits of their gender at the time, their upbringing or station in life, or even self-doubts stop them from doing what they could. Their actions flowed from a religious grounding in the natural and inherent dignity of every person, from democratic principles, and from a spiritual understanding of the principles of equality, justice, and interdependence. Now, the reality is that many of us may have these ideals, but we don't necessarily act on them. Think about others. That was the statement that I grew up hearing. Think about others when you are stuck or feeling sorry for yourself. Even though there's a lot of judgment behind that statement, which today I would not agree with, the gist of that teaching that was passed down to me was that thinking about others was a good thing to do. Thinking about others less fortunate had the effect of shifting one out of a self-centered perspective and connecting one to the world, to society. I see our lived experiences as a spectrum rather than an either-or dichotomy. There's merit in both. Both the inward journey and also the outward commitment to change. The weakness in both is when one rejects entirely the other. When inward seeking becomes a wall of protection against the call of the world, or when a commitment to solving the world's problems cuts oneself off from compassion and self-care. Our culture, not just the individual, has its own expression too. And we are living in a time and a culture that puts individual needs at the top of the heap, to the detriment of the needs of the community or of the earth. The self-focus of the consumer society has warped our natural human impulses to self-reflection and to a care and responsibility for others. We must reject this. We must reject this first world consumer mentality because it's killing us. It's killing our communities. It's killing our planet. And we must reclaim our lives. We must. You know this, and I suspect that one of your motivations to seek out a community like this is for that very reason. Perhaps you're looking for encouragement to seek a better way of life, perhaps affirmation that your instincts are leading you in a healthy direction. Perhaps you simply need to rest here and renew your life force for the work in the community. You know, we tend to think of our spiritual life as a private and self-centered activity, but it is really not. The spiritual journey is, as usual, taken by both going inward and outward. Richard Gilbert says, "The deeper we delve into the innermost recesses of our souls, the more intensely we identify with other human beings. The further inward we explore, the more we see our common humanity. The more the unseen moves us, the more we understand the hidden bonds of community. And so the deeper we probe spiritually, the more we identify with others and cast our lot with them in battling all that keeps us from celebrating these mystic bonds. This is my passionate and enduring center, he says. Gilbert would also say that we must take our spiritual experiences and our inner explorations so seriously that when we come to really know what spiritual love and compassion is, we will be motivated to take this awareness, this learning, and put it into action. It will be a natural flow. He'd say that it is a religious experience to work for the common good, as we saw in the examples of both Florence Nightingale and Dorothy Dix, and that it is necessary for our spiritual health. Spiritual growth takes you on a journey of greater love and connection, if you are willing. Despite the fact that in our whole lives we will never feel fully together, fully ready, despite the fact that we may always feel imperfect, guilty, shamed, frozen, despite all of this, the journey forward toward greater love and greater connectedness will at some point call us out of love to act in the world. And then we'll just do it. Thank you.